Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today we're going to be starting off the show with an interview with a member of the group Heaven and Earth. Keith Stewart is up in here right now, who's going to be telling the story of the group. You want to say hi to the audience?
Hello, listening audience. How are you?
So I guess your group is kind of like on the tail. Like, usually I'm playing groups from the 60s to like the mid 70s. So, and I like that, playing that harmony, that group harmony sound on the show. So your group is on the tail end of that sound, one of the last like real harmony groups coming out of Chicago.
That's pretty much true. We were influenced by a lot of the groups in the 60s and the Detroit groups. So at that point, we had pretty much, you know, modeled our whole thing around that type of style, yes.
Yeah, because like a lot of, by the time you guys were coming out, a lot of the groups became more like the self-contained band was a bigger thing, and they were like funk groups. They were less about the vocal harmony.
Yeah, the band thing was starting to come about, you know, in the mid to late 70s, and disco kind of slid in there. So it affected the group thing as far as how record companies viewed your marketability. But, you know, it was still quite a few popular groups like the OJs, Stylistic Spinners.
Yeah.
All those groups were really, really big at that time. So we didn't feel like what we were doing was, you know, out of pocket or, you know, out of date or anything like that.
But also the record industry was kind of leaving Chicago. So you guys were also one of the last vocal groups to kind of like represent Chicago around that time too. So I wanted to get started actually to talk about how, like, so first of all, where you guys are from, when you formed, and how the group formed.
Well, the long version for purposes of this interview, the group kind of was founded in 1973. The core group was Dwight Dukes, James, his brother James Dukes, and myself, Keith Stewart. And Dwight and I went to high school together.
Okay, what school did you go to?
We went to Leo High School, and his brother James went to Dunbar at the time.
Okay.
So, you know, at that point, Dwight and I were playing basketball on the basketball team together, and we kind of just discovered, both of us had a love for singing, and he and his brother had a group when they were kids.
Okay.
Called the Deltones, and they were kind of like a clone of the Jackson 5. So
okay.
They had aspirations at an early age, and it kind of, you know, fell into this thing. But
you didn't sing before high school, is that right?
No, I dabbled more than anything. I had been exposed to music as a child. We had a piano, I had a guitar. You know, I was exposed to it quite a bit. My father listened to a lot of different kinds of music, but I didn't really take it seriously. I didn't even understand, you know, that I had any musical ability until it was kind of put on me, you know. It just, you know, I didn't know where it came from.
So one thing about a lot of these groups, like a lot of the groups I talk to, they're high school groups, but they, you know, they come from like the 60s era where everybody was harmonizing, you know, like in the hallways and stuff. So how did you learn to sing harmony? Was that something, you know, you started doing when you were singing too?
Well, we, short story as far as that went, one night after a basketball game, I was leaving the game, and Dwight and James, who, even though I knew Dwight from being on the basketball team with him, we weren't really like friends, we just practiced against one another, you know. So I come out of the game that one night, and he and James and another fella were on the corner singing Ooh Baby Baby.
Okay.
And I thought they was like, wow, that was just really cool. So, you know, I knew I could do that, you know, too. I just never told them that, you know. I just didn't know that was, you know, I wasn't really about that.
Okay.
And they were. So, later on, I was in the auditorium playing piano, just dabbling and stuff, and he came in. And so he started singing, and I just jumped in and started singing harmony because I knew, just kind of knew how to do it.
Okay.
And so then from that point on, he knew I sang, and I knew he sang, and, you know, it kind of evolved.
So was that like your, what year in school were you?
We were junior seniors. Like, you know, I guess it would have been junior year when I think I first discovered his ability, and then senior year we kind of talked about it and started to, you know, exchange views on it. You know, we didn't really
talk
about it.
So you talked about forming a group.
Well, we more talked about the love of music. He was kind of, I was more into the fact that he had experience, but he had a group. You know, I was impressed with that because I had never really been in a group per se. You know, I dabbled a little bit you know, when I was a kid, but it was just more dabbling with some neighborhood garage things, you know. So I was exposed to it, but I never really thought about it. They had been doing shows and getting paid.
Did any groups that record come out of your neighborhood that you remember?
Not really, because for me, I was into athletics.
Okay.
I wasn't into music. Well, and let me rephrase that, because that's not really true. I came up in the Burnside area.
Okay.
I came up in a lot of different areas, actually, but one area that I did come up in and was kind of exposed to music at an early age was the Burnside area, which was where the Five Stair Steps came from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I forgot about that, actually, but yeah, that was in the 90s. We lived on 92nd near Cottage Grove.
Okay.
And they were from that same general area. They went to Harlan High School, and a lot of the neighborhood kids at that point did things at Tule Park. They had talent shows and things like that. So, yeah, I guess you could say the
so five you were slightly influenced by the Five Stair Steps then? Is that
that would be safe to say, because you know there were talent shows and things that happened at the time, and the what they were doing didn't necessarily influence me, but it was like it was a fun thing to do.
Okay.
It was a fun thing to do. Yeah.
So then, when did you officially like decide to form a group? Was you and Dwight, did you form the group?
Yeah, essentially what happened, the short version, was I had left to go to college. I was at the University of Illinois down in Champaign-Urbana, and I get a call from Dwight, and he had kind of segued after high school into a professional singing career as another member of the Brighter Side of Darkness, who at the time had the hit called Love...
Love Jones.
And that wasn't working out.
Yeah, they kind of, I know they like split into two groups. Like,
exactly.
I think one of the groups became the Imaginations.
The Imaginations was somebody else, but they became somebody. Actually, from my recollection, it was basically, they were trying to do two Brighter Sides.
Okay.
And they brought Dwight in to do the little hook part on Love Jones with the three background singers, and the lead singer on the actual record took three guys to sing background behind him, because he was going to be the center of attraction, and the group guys were...
So
were,
Dwight's not on the Love Jones, you're just saying he was with the later version?
He was with one of the split versions.
So, yeah. But was he with the group with Daryl? Were you saying he was in a group that didn't have Daryl?
Exactly.
Okay.
He was the Daryl for the three background guys.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so he was the lead of one of the Brighter Side of Darkness.
Right, exactly, right.
So he had been singing, and then how did you end up forming a group with him?
Well, like I said, he called me down in Champaign and said things wasn't working out, and would I be interested in, you know, doing something with him and James? And I said, yeah, well, you know. By that time, we had a lot of history about talking about it. So, yeah. So they came down to Champaign, and we had a rehearsal.
So when was that, like 73?
That would have been the fall of 73.
Okay.
Yeah, that would have been the fall of 73. I had just got there, actually.
Okay.
And there was five of us, actually. There was another fella who came down with them, who was actually the guy I saw singing with them on the corner that day. And
okay.
he was a long-time friend of theirs, and so he's, you know, let's all do this thing.
What was his name?
His name was Wendell. I can't think of his last name right now, but his name was Wendell.
And then what was the fourth person besides him?
And Larry Towers.
Okay.
It would have been Keith Stewart, James Dukes, Wendell, whatever, Larry Towers, and Dwight Dukes.
And was Larry Towers in the Brighter Side of Darkness group, too? Or?
No, Larry was... Larry was somebody that I think Dwight met in the second Brighter Side.
Okay.
Or in some affiliation. Yeah, he was part of that.
So he came up to school to visit you?
And we had a rehearsal. And we had a rehearsal with the five guys. And we ran through some songs to see how everybody's voices matched up. And Larry was a falsetto tenor. Dwight was a tenor. I was a second tenor baritone. Wendell was a second tenor baritone, and James was a baritone bass.
Okay.
So we kind of had the thing covered. We ran through some choreography, and you know, and things started to look like, you know, yeah, well, maybe we'll give this a shot. So they went back to Chicago and called me back and said Wendell wasn't going to stay.
Okay.
And so they said, but we're going to get a show. We're going to do a show.
Okay.
Somewhere. So I started commuting to rehearse for the show. Two or three songs as a feature act for somebody else who I can't remember, was at a club called It was a club on 91st and Racine. Not there anymore. I can't recall the name of it right now. But
okay.
We did the show. And we did two songs. One of them was Head to the Sky by Earth, Wind & Fire.
Okay.
Was a big record at the time.
Yeah.
And the other song was Forever by the Ebonys.
Okay.
And I was hooked. I was hooked bad.
Okay.
I was hooked bad. And from there, we just started practicing.
So did you get a good response at the show?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to... There's still a bunch of story going up to the first record, but I'd like to play the record so, you know, people know what we're talking about and stuff. So this first record, this was your first record, and it was a really big hit, all in your first record. This is I Can't Seem to Forget You. And then afterwards, we'll go up to how this record came out and what the story was. So again, this is Heaven and Earth with I Can't Seem to Forget You. If anyone has any questions, you can call up 773-702-8424.
Of my mind.
I can't walk and kiss me. How can he say? Even kiss to me. I felt the whole human race. My heart has together we say. And oh, I haven't found nobody to take your place. So fill this heart. Get you.
Okay, that was just Heaven and Earth with their first record and the first really big hit, I Can't Seem to Forget You. So we're up in here right now, if you're just tuning in, with Keith Stewart, member of the group, and he's telling the history of the group. So before I played that record, we were talking about how you had just sort of formed the group with the other guys, and you had done a show in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so did you have a name yet? Were you called Heaven and Earth?
No. I can't even recall what we called ourselves on that first show, but it wasn't Heaven and Earth, as I recall. It could have been, but I don't remember. I do remember that there was an occasion, as far as the name, that we went to an audition at a record company, quote-unquote record company, just starting out, and they asked us, you know, for a name.
Okay.
We were batting around names, and I guess we had decided on the name Heaven, just strictly Heaven.
Okay.
And the receptionist at the record company, and we told her, she said, "What's your name of your act?" And we said, "Heaven." She said, "Heaven and Earth." And we said, "No, just Heaven." And she kept saying Heaven and Earth. And so we finally said, "Ah, forget it." And we just left it like that.
So the receptionist made up your name.
The receptionist pretty much made up the name. That's my recollection of it. I'll be sticking with it.
So do you remember what record company it was?
The name of the record company escapes me. I do remember it being 79th off of Jeffrey over East.
Okay.
Somewhere. And they had a record out. I didn't remember the producer's name. The thing that sticks out in my mind about that record company, because it was a really short experience, we didn't really do anything with them. They gave us some sheet music to go home and rehearse a song. And I couldn't read music.
Okay.
You know? So I said, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take my guitar and my piano, and I'm going to make up some music to this guy's words. And that was the first song that I ever wrote. It was called A Part of Me. I would never forget that.
Okay.
Never did anything with it, but I do remember that record company was responsible for me writing my first song.
Okay.
Not long after that, we had just been, you know, kicking around, rehearsing. We rehearsed 7 days a week.
But you were in school then, right?
No, actually, right after this, we did the big show thing. I started commuting back and forth on weekends.
Okay.
Through that whole year, I was a freshman.
Okay.
And at the end of my freshman year, it became clear to me that the university wasn't going to let me play basketball. And I wanted to play basketball. And they said, well, you'd have to meet certain requirements that I won't go into now.
Okay.
Because they're not important to this interview. But you have to meet certain requirements. And I said, well, if I can't play basketball, I'm not coming back.
Okay.
So at that point, I decided to jump off and try to sing.
Okay.
So that summer is when, you know, the summer would have been 74, was when we started really kind of trying to see, you know, what we could get going. And, you know, we did a few little local things. We rehearsed a lot. I mean, that's what we did. We rehearsed 5-6 days a week, 3-4 hours a day on other people's material, just choreographing it and just becoming a group.
So you tightened up your harmony at that point?
Yeah, we kind of got a chemistry for what was going on. I understood how they worked. We practiced different kinds of harmonies. You know, we just found out what one another could do, and that would have been me, Dwight, James, and Larry Towers.
So then how did you end up finally getting hooked up with a record label, and
well,
what's the story?
Basically, at whatever point during that 74, early 75, Dwight had a relationship with the manager of the other Incantation of Brighter Side.
Okay.
A woman by the name of Liz Schneider.
Okay.
And because Liz Schneider had managed the whole group at one point, she had the relationship with Clarence Johnson.
Okay.
So one day, she heard us. Dwight had arranged to have her hear us sing.
Okay.
And we had practiced a lot of different songs, mostly a lot of a cappella, but we had a song that we used to sing a lot by the Impressions that would just blow everybody out of the water. Called Never Let You Go.
Okay, yeah.
Luther Vandross covered it later on, but
okay.
It was a great song. I had never, ever heard the song. They taught it to me. I felt like, just sing when we tell you to sing. And every time we get ready, we used to call it the blowout. Every
okay.
time we would sing this song, everybody would just say, ooh, ooh, ooh. So it kind of worked out that way. Anyway, we go to sing for Liz, and we sing the blowout, and she says, hey, I'm going to introduce you to Clarence. And one afternoon, we came to her house, Clarence was singing everything, we sang the blowout, he said, I want to sign you.
Okay.
So we were signed to his label, his production company.
So was Liz your manager at the time then?
She decided, we elected to let her be our manager. I mean, okay. We didn't know anything about management at the time. She talked a good game, and she had the brightest side, so that was a feather in her cap as far as I was concerned, you know.
And Clarence signed you to the label.
And Clarence signed us to his production company.
Okay. Was it GEC?
That would have been GEC Records, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then he put out your first record, the one we just played, I Can't Seem to Forget You.
Right.
And so that came out in, like, 75.
That came out in 75, that's correct. Yeah.
So pretty much, did that come out right after he signed you? You went to the studio and recorded it?
Well, yeah, it was kind of funny because we practiced a lot, and we prided ourselves on learning and being really professional, you know, about it. We were really serious about it. So we kind of impressed everybody at the company with how good we were in the studio. Even though we didn't have a lot of experience, we just took to it really well.
Okay.
The first thing, you know, we recorded like 17, 18 sides in 6 months, and one of them would have been, one of them was I Can't Seem to Forget You. So there was an album in place pretty quick.
Okay.
Because of how well we adapted to that whole environment thing.
Yeah, and the whole album is excellent. Like, just all really quality.
Thank you. Thank
material.
You.
Like, thank just, you. Just the, but the only record that actually got released was I Can't Seem to Forget You on it.
That's the only record. That was the main one that made noise. I think they released Let Me Back In, got a little airplay over time.
No, oh, okay. I've never seen that. Maybe it got airplay off the album or something.
I don't know if they dropped a single on it. I remember getting to my linear play.
That record, the I Can't Seem to Forget You, it was the first big hit for songwriters Maurice Commander and Jerlene Shelton.
Yeah.
So do you remember working with them at all?
Yeah, they were nice people. They were good people. Maurice was a keyboard player and Jerlene was a singer, and she had this high voice and it was perfect for Dwight. And, you know, she just wrote songs that fit in his thing, you know, and it kind of was a good match as far as, you know, how she made her melodies flow, you know, and things, you know, so it was a pretty good match, you know, for the time being.
Okay, and then who were the ultimate, like, the people singing on all the tracks on the record? Is it the same lineup on all the tracks on the record?
On that record, I want to say pretty much that record was made with Dwight, James, myself, and Larry Towers.
So Dwight Dukes, James Dukes, Keith Stewart, and Larry Towers.
Right.
But then they're not even the people in the picture. Larry's not in the picture.
That's another story altogether.
Okay.
The thing about the Heaven and Earth that's important to note, for anybody that wants to know the real deal, Heaven and Earth has three founding members, core members.
Okay.
That would be Dwight, James, Dukes, and myself, Keith Stewart.
Okay.
Without slighting anyone, the fourth member of Heaven and Earth changed about six times.
Okay.
So it's important to acknowledge all of those guys because they were legitimate members. They all contributed heavily. And,
so who sang each part on the record too? Like, who sang lead?
Well, it really varied because, and that was one of the strengths of the group. We would taper our harmonies to fit the song. Dwight was so good that he was versatile enough to be able to sing a lot of different parts. James was too, and I kind of learned to do that from them. So we would switch our vocals around to fit the fourth member or to fit the song.
So who sang lead on I Can't Seem to Forget You?
Well, that would have been Dwight and James.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the primary leads at the time. Even though I had musical talent, musical ability, I think at the time their experience was better suited for the leads at the time. And I think the production company thought the same thing. I was more of the spokesman and the choreographer.
Okay.
I wrote songs. You know, so I had a major role, but it worked out chemistry-wise because none of us stepped on the other one's toes, so to speak. And the fourth member always fit a particular slot that we might have been missing, but for whatever reason, that fourth person always faded out.
Okay.
So the person on the picture, Michael Brown, was an important member, and he stayed with us a number of years, 2 to 3 years. And he is on that record. He's not on every song,
okay,
but he's on some songs. So I know he's on the Window Lady and a couple of others.
So I want to get into sort of how the membership changed, but I want to play another song. So,
cool.
So this song I'm going to play is actually not on the album, but it was the flip, the B-side of I Can't Seem to Forget You. This is an excellent. You don't like this record?
Well, no, I don't dislike any of the records. Not in retrospect.
But this record, I really like this record a lot. So I'm gonna play.
Okay, cool.
This song is called Promises. This is Heaven and Earth with Promises. Okay, that was just, first of all, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're tuned to the Sitting in the Park show. That was just Heaven and Earth with Promises. That was the B-side of their first hit, I Can't Seem to Forget You. Actually, I interviewed the guy who wrote the lyrics to that song, guy named Wayne Reedus. He was in a few groups. But yeah, he said he never met you guys or anything, and that Ruth Moore just brought the music to him and had him write the lyrics.
As I recall, I think it was like a late thing. That's why it's not on the album. It was something that they kind of just pulled off the shelf and said, hey, record this. And we did it, and they just put on a single because they wanted to put out the single.
So we never got to actually. So the single came out. He put out the single on you on his record label, and it was a huge hit in Chicago, right? So
what's regionally, it was a big hit regionally.
And it charted nationally, too. I could look it up in a second. So what happened? So first of all, you had this big hit that got heavy play in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
So were you real excited at the time? And it was your first record, too, actually.
It was the first time we ever sang in the studio. It was the first time we did anything. And it was like a little taste of fame. And, you know, people would recognize you and... we do shows and the girls and you know the whole thing. You know, we're young, 21, 22 years old, you know, and you really think you're gonna make it, you know what I'm saying? You kinda think you're gonna be, you know, stars. And so it was sort of exciting.
So you started to do a lot more shows, is that
right?
Yeah,
we did a lot of shows. We were able to do a lot of shows around the Midwest, around the country. And
so you toured nationally off of the record?
I would say we probably toured regionally more in the Midwest because the record did real well, like Detroit, Milwaukee, Indianapolis, St. Louis. It did real well in Seattle, but we never got out to Seattle.
Okay.
It did well in a lot of regions. So, you know, it was kind of like we would just go to the regions where it was doing well and, you know, make the money.
Okay. But it definitely did chart on the, like, the national Billboard.
Yeah, it charted nationally.
So, but obviously it doesn't have to hit in every city.
Exactly, right.
So
you can have enough, you can move enough pieces to get a good number on the regional hit.
Yeah, this book says, so you kind of got bottom of the, you got 83 on the Billboard R&B charts, which is still pretty good, especially if you did well regionally.
Right.
So that off that record, you were telling me that you did a lot of like promotional stuff with other DJs when that came out.
Yeah, at that time, that was sort of the quote unquote payola that you had to deal with. Radio was still where you had to deal with program directors, and individual jocks had enough power or enough clout to play the records that they liked to play. So production company and management, you know, kind of said, listen, you know, if this DJ or that DJ is doing a club here and he's promoting, you can go and, you know, in do sales by doing a lip sync version of the record. It was always lip sync because this was pre-head tracks.
Yeah.
Nobody did that, so all you did was lip sync.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the 60s, other groups, they did record hops, but
right.
I guess you didn't call them record hops.
But that's what they basically were. You know, they were record hops, they were sets.
So you remember some of the DJs that played your record that you had to do shows for?
Oh, sure, yeah. Herb Kent, Rich Pergee,
okay.
Tom Joyner, because Tom Joyner was local originally. Tom Joyner originated at WJPC.
Yeah.
And back then he was really popular. He's the same guy, absolutely the same guy. And he was real good to us early on, and he had us come out to a lot of his sets. And his sets were the biggest, actually, because he was the most popular jock here.
Okay.
And E. Rodney Jones, Lucky Cordell. Those were the biggest guys at the time. You know, I think that VON was still pretty like the number one station before they really moved into FM. I think JPC was AM too back then.
Okay.
You know, this was pre-FM, we talking.
Okay. I think it might have been 1450
WVON back in
those
days.
Well, I know VON, well, it still is.
And JPC was 9-something, 960 something like that. I'm not sure about that one. But
okay.
Yeah.
So then, so for some reason, that was the only real single that they put out off the album.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, from my estimation, you know, that was probably the best song.
Okay.
It was the catchiest song, no doubt.
So then, what happened? You eventually got signed to Mercury Records and had your biggest hit on Mercury Records. So what's the story? How did you switch labels, and were you still with the same manager and Clarence Johnson?
The management thing was going through a transition. We had elected to drop Liz Schneider.
Okay.
And we got with another individual who we actually met through Lil Schneider, and he became our manager, and he became our personal manager.
Who do you remember who it
His
was?
His name was Jim Wilson.
Okay.
Who's still a good friend of mine. We spoke maybe in the last year or so. And he took us to ECI Management Company, who was a company that was headed by Jerry Butler.
Okay.
And
So that's like ICE spelled backwards?
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, they were big time. They were down on Michigan Avenue, and, you know, he had the Jerry Butler thing, and he had a writing stable, because back then Jerry Butler was doing some things with a writing workshop. He had Leroy Hudson. He had a lot of other writers that was coming through there doing things, Keith and Carter and people like that.
Okay.
But they wanted to take us to another level.
Okay.
Clarence was shopping around because he had a deal with 20th Century for the GEC record.
Okay.
That had actually fallen through. So
he put it out on his own label. He originally was supposed to be on 20th Century.
Well, no, actually he put I Can't Seem to Forget You out on GEC. It was picked up by 20th Century.
It was distributed
by 20th Century. So it didn't really, you know, that was later on, but that deal kind of fell through. And
okay.
It just kind of just didn't quite pan out, and he was left trying to find a thing. So he met a guy by the name of Bill Haywood at Mercury Records, and Bill Haywood was from Chicago, so he was familiar with the act from the noise that we had made in Chicago. and they kind of struck up a deal. He went to Mercury and took some records, you know, some of the I Can't Seem to Forget You project, and was able to pull something off.
Okay. So I guess the deal was that Clarence Johnson, so you were managed by, at that time, you had a personal manager, and then you were under Jerry Butler's management company, and Clarence Johnson was your producer.
So
he was the guy that had the deal with the record labels.
Exactly.
And you had a contract with Clarence.
We had a production contract with Clarence that really was still in effect from the original contract that we had with them.
Okay.
You know, we didn't change contracts, I don't think. We might have signed a new deal when we got the Mercury deal. As I recall, there was some controversy about that, because what he was doing at the time was he had a 5-year deal when we signed with GEC, and then he wanted a new 5-year deal.
Okay.
When he got Mercury, he was like, no, you know, matter of fact, our management company said at the time, that's not a good move to sign a new 5-year deal with this guy.
Okay.
You know, when we could probably get you guys a separate, you know, get you guys another deal outside of Mercury, you know.
So, and what was the story? So already when you were on GEC, Michael Brown replaced Larry Tower. What's the deal with that?
Well, Larry had a few problems, and we just kind of parted ways.
Okay.
There was some controversy about some different things. You know how groups do. You have difference of opinion. And
people always fighting
in
terms.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, rather than go into the detail, I don't want to be unfactual.
Okay.
So there was some controversy, and we just decided to part company.
So then by the time you were on Mercury, what was the lineup?
Well, when we got to Mercury, well, I skipped over Mike Brown because we actually let him go too in between that time.
So he was on some of the GEC stuff, but he wasn't on Mercury?
Right. Mike Brown didn't make the Mercury stuff. We had cut him loose by that time. And in actuality, we probably cut Mike Brown loose around 77, 78.
Okay.
And we were operating with 3 people.
Okay.
And we went in the studio under the Mercury deal with 3 people.
Okay.
We started recording some of the songs for the...
Well, how about, I'll break it up for a second. Let me play the record, and we can go back in the story about how long it formed. So this was actually the biggest hit you ever did, and I think it charted 42 on the Billboard thing, but this is the record that Herb Camp plays every week.
Yeah.
This is Heaven and Earth with, this came out in 78, this is Guess Who's Back in Town, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about sort of how the record came about.
Cool. It's good to know.
Okay, that was just Heaven and Earth with their biggest hit, Guess Who's Back in Town. Came out on Mercury Records in 1978. So we were just talking about how you guys got to Mercury Records, how Clarence Johnson had brought you over to that label, and he was the producer, and you were under Jerry Butler's management at the time. So, first of all, what's the story? There was a different person. You had a different group member replace Michael Brown on that record, right?
Well, as I said, after Mike left, we contemplated going with three.
Okay.
We just didn't see where another guy was going to fit into our way of thinking. We had gone out and done some shows with three people. But another point to note is we had a percussionist by the name of Raphael Miles.
Okay.
Who filled in and was an actual member of the group also. So we had four when we needed four.
Okay.
We did three when we wanted to do three. But it's important to note Ray Miles' contribution because Ray was a legitimate member. He never recorded any records with us, but he was there.
He sang the fourth part.
He sang the fourth part all the time.
Okay.
But about the time we got to doing the demos for the Guess Who record, it was determined that Ray wasn't the right voice for the record.
Okay.
And we started trying it with three, and Clarence and those guys decided, well, you got to get another guy. And at the time, Teddy Pendergrass sound was kind of happening because he was a big act at the time.
Okay.
We came to the studio one day, and this guy singing at the mic, and it was Dean Williams.
Wait, you mean he was at the studio for some other reason?
No, he was there singing Guess Who's Back in Town. When we got to the studio one day to record Guess Who's Back in Town, that was a rehearsal, Clarence had recruited him.
So Clarence just put him in the group.
He recruited him to be in the group. He didn't actually say, you know, you go take him. But the cool thing of it, as I recall, Dean blew everybody away in the studio.
So he and the main reason he got him was because you said he had a Teddy Pendergrass
type style.
Voice. Okay.
And we heard him singing Guess Who's Back in Town, the very record that you heard, almost like that in one or two takes, and he just blew everybody away.
Okay.
You know.
So
we took him on.
Okay, so
we just had to take him on.
So he was recruited by Clarence to be on record. So that was your biggest hit. So one thing to note is that was written by Rodney Massey and Lawrence Hanks. So who was Rodney Massey?
Rodney was a guy from Benton Harbor, Michigan, who had been writing in Jerry Butler's workshop.
Okay,
and he had been cultivating a talent in that capacity, and you know, he had some songs and. Clarence was looking for songs, and he kind of, you know, pulled it out of the hat, and Clarence liked it, and, you know, it was an easy song to like. You know, it sounded cool, even as piano.
Okay.
So, you know, he was a guy who was really talented and really could have been a big writer. He had a knack for it. He wrote some songs on the...
like he had done some earlier stuff with Clarence, I think, because I...
Well, actually, he wrote something on the I Can't Seem to Forget You album. I think he wrote a song called Nature's Miracle.
Yeah, I've seen his names on some, like, early 70s records that Clarence put out, too.
Yeah, he was a young guy. I think at the time, Rodney might have been a teenager.
Okay.
You know, at the time, you know. He was close in age to us. He might have been a little older, but not by much.
Okay.
He has gone on to make money in the hair care industry.
Okay.
But anyway... he had those guys, and they had some songs, and Guess Who was one of them, and another one was Let's Work It Out. I think those were the two main songs.
But he wanted to do a song on you that he ended up doing himself, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. There was a song back in the, I guess, maybe early 80s, late 70s. There was a contractual money fallout between he and Clarence, and he was going to give us a song called You Make It Happen, and it was supposed to be the follow-up to Guess Who's Back in Town.
Okay.
And for whatever discrepancy they couldn't resolve, Rodney ended up recording the song on his own group, a group called Omni.
Okay.
And put the record out. And the record did pretty good.
It was a regional, local hit at least.
Yeah, kind of local. You know, it got a nice amount of airplay because it was a really nice song that would have only been better had we recorded it.
So You Make It Happen was supposed to be for you.
For Heaven and Earth.
And then Rodney couldn't work out a deal with Clarence or Jerry Butler with Clarence, and then I think and then he recorded under his own group Omni, which
right.
I think we're also under Jerry Butler.
Right. I forget exactly what label they used, but they
it was on his Fountain record. I think it was Jerry Butler's label or something. Yeah.
Well, but they knew they had a good song, and they just decided to try to put it out anyway, see what would happen.
So at the time you got that big hit, did you start doing more national shows?
Yeah, we toured nationally. We did the TV shows, the Soul Trains.
Okay.
Other local television, you know, we did a lot of regional local television. The equivalent of Soul Train, we did that in Cleveland, and we did it in Philadelphia.
Do you remember the names of some of the shows? What was the Cleveland show?
I can't remember the name of the Cleveland show, but I tell you one thing that was interesting about the Cleveland show that I do remember. We did the show with a group that was called at the time called Kinsman Daz, and they were from Cleveland. They ended up becoming the Daz Band.
Yeah.
And they were really good at the time. We was like, man, these guys are really good, you know. And later on, we found out they were the Daz Band from Cleveland.
Okay.
But you know, things like that. And, you know, we did California, we did Soul Train, we did, you know, tours around with the name acts, OJs and Cool Gang and Rose Royce.
So you got to perform with some of the groups that inspired you originally, too.
Yeah, we got a chance to do shows with the Spinners, the Dells, you know, some of everybody, Marvin Gaye, you know,
okay,
the whole bit.
So and so off of that album, I think that was the only record that got even put out as a single, I think, off of that first record.
Yeah, I don't think that they did much to try to promote any other songs. I think they were trying to promote Let's Work It Out a little bit.
Okay.
That was off the Guess Who album.
Okay.
But the management company and the production company was kind of at odds around that point because, you know, we weren't really getting along with Dean that well, you know.
Okay.
He didn't work the way we wanted to work, and, you know, it just wasn't working out with him. We were kind of just tooth and nail, kind of just trying to hold it together.
Okay.
And, you know, eventually we just kind of said, hey, you know, we're going to promote Dwight, and the production company wanted to promote Dean, and so there was just a big, you know, a big rift that we just couldn't seem to get together.
Okay. So then they recorded a whole nother album on you on Mercury that actually had a few singles that at least hit the charts, and they must have gotten a little bit of play. So Mercury recorded a second album from you, and one single they released was called I Feel a Groove Under My Feet. And
yeah,
and you said that didn't get that nothing
that,
much.
That whole that. Album, that was an album called Fantasy. And the short story on that album was that album was made under protest, under duress.
Okay.
But the group had already split with Dean. The songs were written for a voice like Dean.
Okay.
Well, actually, I should say the songs were written for Dean. They were also written after the deal had fallen through for You Make It Happen.
Okay.
So Rodney and Larry weren't going to be participating on this project. They had to find some new writers. They found some guys that would work for cheap or work for nothing or whatever, you know, those guys did it for. And none of the songs were written for Dwight.
Okay.
So originally our management company didn't want us to record the album at all, but we caved in because, you know, we needed to have a record out. It had been a year or so.
Was your contract with Clarence?
Well, we were kind of sitting, and he was like, well, you know, we're going to put y'all on the shelf. You know, you want to put something out. You get a record, get a hit record. Now you're not coming back for who God knows how long. You lose your spot.
Yeah.
So it was kind of pressure from all sides to do another record.
But you were saying it was just kind of thrown together.
It was just kind of thrown together.
So who's singing on the record?
Well, once again, when Dean split to do a solo project, we were forced to take another baritone by the name of Greg Rose.
Okay. Was he in the Rose Brothers, is that right?
He ended up actually moving on past us to do a thing with his brothers called the Rose Brothers.
Okay.
He was a Teddy Pendergrass clone.
Okay.
But
so how did he get into your group?
He actually technically was not in the group. I would probably say he gets his name in the members of Heaven and Earth because he's actually on a recording.
Okay.
He never did a show with us. He never made a personal appearance with us. And
so who brought him to the? Do you know who brought him to the studio? Even
if I had to guess, and I'm guessing, I would say Rick Williams.
Okay.
But it would have been between he and Clarence and Rick Williams. He recorded his tracks without us being in the studio.
Okay.
We sang the background.
So you didn't have contact
to the tracks.
With him, really?
No, we never. We only had one contact with him. I'll tell you that story is really short. But we sang the background tracks. Like I said, under duress, we sang them under protest, not knowing how the songs were going to go, knowing how the songs were going to come off, and we came actually to a listening session of the finished product. That's how bad things had gotten.
So you had a minor hit off the album. It was a cover of I Only Have Eyes For You.
That's the only good thing that came out of the record, because they only released that song from the record. They didn't release any of the songs that Greg...
Well,
they did release I Feel a Groove, technically, but there was never really any record company support for the record.
Okay.
And, yes, the record will show that... history will show that record was released, but it really never...
But is Greg singing lead on I Only Have Eyes For You?
No. That would be Dwight Deuce.
Okay.
Right. And like I said, that kind of saved our necks from that standpoint, because that record, because it was a cover and because we had the name, was able to get a significant amount of airplay and keep the name out there, and we were able to work for the next year. Plus,
okay.
You know,
so then,
off that record.
So then after that, I guess you left Mercury and ended up at Philly label TEC, which at the time, I think William Devon was on.
Right.
He was with him, and then that label became WMOT. So what's the story? How'd you get hooked up with this Philly label?
Well, Jerry Butler had some affiliation with Philadelphia because of his time with Gamblin' Huff.
Okay.
Back in the early 70s, late 60s. And there was some conversation between some of their connections there with this new label that had money that was going to do national distribution, blah, blah, blah. And we had finally managed to legally separate ourselves from Clarence. And so he said, let's go take a listen. They flew us out and, it sounded like a winner. Plus we had, that was a year and a half after, I Only Have Eyes for You. So we were like, hungry for a deal. Anybody sign us, please.
Okay.
So, we went out there, and it was away from Chicago, and that was another big thing for us, too, because, okay, finally, we're getting away from the Chicago,
Were you still with Clarence as a producer?
No.
Okay.
No, we separated. We divorced ourselves from Clarence after the Fantasy record.
Okay.
We broke ties legally and contractually with Clarence because, as I recall, when we signed the Mercury deal, Clarence wanted a new five-year deal. We didn't give him a new five-year deal, so his deal actually expired from the time we signed the original contract with GEC to the Mercury thing. So we were within 5 years total.
Okay.
We served our full contract with Clarence. Our contract ran out.
Okay.
And so at that point, we were just without a deal. Mercury dropped the act because of all the fighting.
Okay.
And, we just were looking for a new deal.
So then Jerry Butler brought you to TEC.
Yeah.
So you put out a couple singles on it. I want to play... This record is totally excellent. I was listening to it. I hadn't really ever listened to it. I kind of had it, and then I was listening to it to get ready for an interview, and I think this is really good, so I'll play it, and then we'll talk some more. If anyone has questions, they can call up 773-702-8424. This is Heaven and Earth, and this track, I think, is from 79 or 80, and it's called Just in Time.
Like a tire to see one's
Okay, that was just Heaven and Earth with their record Just in Time. You're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're listening to the Sitting in the Park show, and you're listening to an interview with member of Heaven and Earth, Keith Stewart. So we were just talking about how that record, Just in Time, came out on TEC Records out of Philadelphia in 79 or 80, probably around that time. First of all, that track is totally excellent. I just want to...
Actually, you know, it's funny because I hadn't heard it for quite some time. It's been, maybe 10 years or so since I heard it. And it actually sounds better than I thought it was going to sound.
Yeah, I mean, just by 1980, there weren't many really good, like, the harmony sound was kind of out, but that just had a really, you guys had really tight harmony, and it was just a real nice
sound. We had
been
singing together by that time about 8-9 years, and our voices were, we were probably 24, 25. Our voices were a lot more mature. Now that I'm hearing it, we still had the ability to sing real high because that was one of the things we could do when we were young. We sang a lot of falsetto type harmony, so we were really maturing as a vocal group. We really had a handle on harmony.
Okay.
And that the record, the album that was from called That's Love, featured a lot of really jazz harmonies, a lot of harmonies that were a lot more complex than the regular doo-wop stuff, because we really kind of wanted to move in that direction.
So who's singing on that record? You had someone, not Greg Rose, right?
No, that okay. wasn't Greg Rose. Greg Rose never actually sang with the group, and we made it clear that he wasn't going to sing with the group. We recruited another fellow by the name of Charles Blackman,
okay,
who became the last member, technically, of the recording groups of Heaven and Earth. He was somebody that we kind of met. We had been holding private auditions, you know, because at that time the name was pretty well known, so we kind of put the word out, and guys would come to the offices and audition for people.
Okay.
And he passed an audition.
So the office is in Chicago or in Philly?
Yeah, down in North Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah, the management company.
You weren't based in Philly at that time? You were just at
We were just recording. The record company was there, and we recorded the material there, but we were still based in Chicago.
Okay.
So, you know, our correspondence was back and forth, but we didn't have to be in Philly other than to record or maybe promote on the East Coast, because they had a stronger base on the East Coast.
Yeah, the record industry was kind of dying in Chicago at the time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so how did Charles Blackman just audition for you? You were saying
he kind of auditioned. Yeah, he heard about an audition and he went and did that. And we kind of said, yeah, he had the look and he had the he had kind of the sound that we that was sticking with the Teddy Pendergrass sound. He probably had the roughest. He was more like Wilson Pickett than
okay.
Teddy Pendergrass, but. You know, he had that going for him, and he was a good dancer. He worked hard. He was a good member.
Okay. Good member. So it was your first, like, real member, fourth member in a while. Who real in the sense that he was, like, part of the group.
Real in the sense that he was, like, part
shows.
Of the group, right. He did shows, yeah.
So
yeah.
Then that label, that record that I just played wasn't a hit. And that was written by you and your brother, right? Which is
right.
The first song, one of the first songs released that you actually wrote.
Right. I had written songs on all of the records. Dwight and I had co-wrote on both the other two records. We didn't get anything on the Fantasy record, which I'm not that sad about.
Okay.
But my brother and I had written this song, Just in Time. And at the time when the song was written, short story, the Bee Gees was a big group.
Okay.
And the group, Heaven and Earth, we did a medley of Bee Gees stuff because Dwight had the tenor and falsetto thing, and we were doing that. So when we wrote Just in Time, we wrote it with a Bee Gees feel in
okay.
mind. And so not really being producers and not really knowing how to produce rhythm tracks, the record company liked the song and said, well, okay, well, give us the song, and we're going to let our people produce it.
Okay.
So we get to the studio, and the guy fires up the song, and it's got this really heavy beat, like that, boom, cha-cha, boom, boom. And I hated it.
Okay.
I absolutely hated it. No, what did you do to my song? I hate it.
Okay.
But people liked it. And just like you said, people liked it. So, you know, I always look back at it like, you know, what do I know? I don't know anything.
But just that song ended up because you were trying to sound like the Bee Gees.
Yeah, right. And if you listen to the harmonies and the lyrics especially had the give kind of poetic flavor to it, it was, yeah, we were trying to do a Bee Gees kind of thing.
Okay. So then that record, they actually didn't promote it or Really?
They didn't do a lot to promote that record, but it did do well in Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah, but and it did well in Chicago
I find it in Chicago sometimes.
Yeah,
so
it did well in Chicago because we already had the name. So people, the jocks would still play the record, and we did real well with it there.
So then they released one more record, which actually did well on you, called I Really Love You.
Yeah, Really Love You.
That almost hit top 40 in the Billboard charts, the national
charts. But it did better away from Chicago.
Okay.
Just in Time did really well here to keep our name floating.
Okay.
You know, but I Really Love You actually got us nationally out east. We were able to do a lot of shows in New York, like Studio 54 kind of things.
And okay.
We were able to, you know, we were kind of like dovetailing off the disco thing, because that's why I Really Love You kind of had a disco vibe to it. It wasn't a disco record, but it's more funkier. But it did well in the clubs. It had a good club feel, you know.
Okay.
So it fit in from that standpoint. And Dwight sang it real well. And that record, the That's Love album, was not a bad album. It wasn't bad.
So then they released the whole album on you. And then what happened? Did the record label go under? Did your contract expire?
Well, you know, there was some funny money kind of stuff happening with the record company. They had some legal problems. There was some, you know, record company issues, obviously, you know, and they went under. They went under. They went under not too long after they had the fellow that did Double Dutch Bus was on that.
Yeah, Frankie, whatever his name was.
Double Dutch Bus. and that was like the reason, that was one of the other reasons why we ended up with that label. That record was huge. We was like, well, you know, if they can promote that huge, they can promote us.
Okay.
And, that they went under after Double Dutch Bus and us. And they might have had a couple of other ones, I can't recall. You know, they were kind of like a version of GEC, only they were based in Philadelphia.
Okay.
But that's what we discovered later. That's basically what they were.
Just like kind of a small, kind of shady operation.
Yeah, you know, okay. And they kind of went under. There were a few people. There was a producer called Nick Martinelli, who had done some major things back in the 80s, and disco, a lot of disco records. He was a pretty famous guy, you know, they had in their house.
So then your group broke up after that?
Yeah, you know, when the records died out, I guess we have a year and a half out of that, we fell out with the management company. The management company dropped us. And we were trying to hang it together. We were kind of trying to morph it into a couple of other incantations with a self-contained thing. We kind of gave into that, and we brought on some musicians, and we were going to be a bigger kind of self-contained thing. And the writing thing kind of had started to blossom, so we were in the studio a lot, kind of developing our own ideas. But we were conflicting then. We were clashing.
Okay.
Because creatively, you know, we weren't all on the same page. And, you know, it just kind of had ran its course. And at one point we just had this big long meeting and decided, you know, the three of us actually, it was the only thing that was left. We just had this big long meeting and just decided to, you know, pull the plug.
So did any of the members go on to do things with other groups around that time?
Yeah, actually, they did. Through the connection with Philadelphia, Dwight was able to do some session work with some producers there that ultimately became a group called Kashmir.
Okay.
And he, they did a song called Do It Any Way You Wanna, I think that's the name of it.
Okay.
And it did real well over in Europe for a long time. He went over there and did some things.
Were you involved with anything else at the time? What happened with you?
No, I kind of tried to keep the Heaven and Earth thing afloat with a self-contained group, and Charles Blackman and I kind of worked it for a little while, but we wore on each other, and I decided to divorce myself from him.
Okay.
And from that point, you know, I just kind of let it go and decided to become a writer full time.
So you write for other people, you're saying?
Yeah, I write for whoever, you know. It might be songs, I'm a writer.
Do you do music full time?
I do music almost full time, yes. I do real estate as part of my other source of income. But yeah, I write and produce music. I still sing quite a bit.
Did you write any hits for anybody or anything that got released in the
80s?
We
did some things in the 80s, some unreleased stuff on Natalie Cole.
We
did a song that was released called Hurry Back on Carl Anderson.
Okay.
Rest in peace, Carl Anderson. We've done a few things. Nothing that's really made any significant noise. Did a few jingles that, you know, did okay. We did a a jingle for the state of South Carolina.
Okay.
That ran for their board of tourism.
Okay.
And, you know, things, just different things that just kind of just, you know, we got into the music thing from the standpoint of technology. So, you know, I'm heavy into the studio thing now with some of the computer technology. So I've stayed in it heavily as a writer and singer.
So you gave me a CD of a recent project you've
right.
done, and it's called Steppin' Odyssey.
Well, yeah.
So it's like steps, like a Steppers type thing, right?
Yeah, I guess in a general sense, I have a production company called Musicale LTD. We've been producing music now since about 1990, and over time we've produced a few local acts and trying to get them going. And one day back, I guess a couple of years ago, we were going through our library and discovered we had all these songs that kind of had a common thread.
Okay.
And so when we said that, you know, well, why don't we put together a compilation of some of our, you know, fine Chicago artists and, you know, see if we can, you know, promote it and do something.
Okay.
So we did. And there's 15 songs on the CD. It's available on CDBaby.com.
Is it in any of the stores in Chicago?
Actually, it is. It's at Coop's on 47th in Lake Park. It's at Dr. Wax.
Okay.
Right here in Hyde Park on 57th.
Okay.
It's at George's Music Room. It's at Fletcher's One Stop. You know.
And this came out, you put this out recently?
We put that out in 2005.
Okay. And so I'm going to play one of the songs off of the CD. This song's called Keep On Steppin'. So singing lead on this is Marzette Griffith from Essence. But you're singing backup as one on the on the CD. It says.
That's correct. Yeah.
And it says another person singing is Dick Fowler.
Right. Right after my career ended with Heaven and Earth, I met Dick Fowler, who was you know, a local singer with some of the groups.
Was that, he was in Starview? Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was in Starview, which was one of Clarence Johnson's groups, and we just kind of knew each other from having competing groups, kind of thing.
Okay.
And you know, one thing led to another. We started discussing the common thread of songwriting, and we just have developed a relationship and maintained it for maybe the last 10-15 years.
Okay.
And we've been writing together and own a studio together, and he and I, you know, still both sing in orchestras around town.
Okay.
And jingles and things. And, you know, we've been working together in that capacity.
So I'm going to play a song off of the CD. This, again, is called Keep On Steppin'. And if anyone has any questions, you can call up 773-702-8424.
Come on and tell me something new. You're just not feeling me, and I sure ain't pleasing you. Time after time again, you say you wanna make a change. I'd rather let you go than play these foolish games. 'Cause I played a fool before, and I learned my lesson well. So I make for the door rather than to be somebody.
My blessing, hey, keep on.
Okay, that was just a track called Keep on Steppin' with Marzette Griffiths singing lead and background by Keith Stewart and Dick Fowler. And that was off of a new CD you were talking about you put out called A Steppin' Odyssey that people could get in stores and on the internet. Where could they get it on the internet again? Because we have some internet
it's
listeners.
It's available on www.cdbaby.com. Just type in The Long Shot Sessions. And, you know, you'll be taken to it and you can help support the project. It's a good record.
Okay. And this CD, you told me the song that was getting someplace called Step With You.
Right. That song was doing real well on 106.3, the major stations, and 102.7. It's doing some things. And, you know, it's been real positive.
Okay. And finally, I guess, nearing the end of the interview, I guess I wanted to ask, what's Dwight Dukes or any of the other members doing now?
Well, Dwight is heavily involved in the gospel genre of music. He's a vocalist, a lead vocalist with a church out in Tinley Park, a big ministry out there, who broadcasts over the internet, and they broadcast on cable. I can't recall the name of the church, but it's really big. I do know that. They've got thousands of folks that he sings in front of. So he's working at a really high level in that, and we still correspond occasionally. We're still on good terms. His brother does home decorating. He's a carpenter and a home renovator and things.
Okay.
And that. And everybody else is kind of scattered about. I've seen and talked to different guys. I've talked to Mike Brown in the last few years. I haven't talked to Charles Blackman for a while. Dean Williams is living in Las Vegas. I've talked to him, actually, because he was part of the Long Shot Project. He's on two tracks, Heaven and Earth tracks that we did for this record. And he's on a solo track called This Time I'm Going to Be Sweeter.
Okay.
Dean Williams is singing on those. So we're still on good terms for the most part. And, you know, it's been you know, fun. Everybody's grown up now, so you know, we let bygones be bygones, and we've talked it all out and hashed it out, and everybody's, you know, cool with one another.
Cool. So it's cool to hear that you're still involved with music and other people are still involved with music. And any last words for the audience?
Hey, man, I'm just happy to be here, man, you know, and I'm glad and I'm thankful that you are recognizing this kind of music, and, you know, hopefully other people will step up and tell their story about their careers and things, you know, so I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming and telling your story. Definitely, like, an interesting, and definitely it's about the sort of the tail end of the harmony era that I play, so it's definitely interesting to hear that part of the story, too. So this last record I'm going to play is off of your new CD that you've been talking about, and this is actually a Heaven and Earth track. And this is called Love Saved My Life. So thanks again. And if you have any last-minute questions, you call up 773-702-8424.
Why don't you give God the glory? Let him in your life right now. I got to tell